My name is Sam Clements, and welcome to this mini episode of the Picture House podcast. Today, I'm going to be talking about American Animals with director Bart Layton. Bart Layton is a director I've been lucky enough to work with in a small way in the past. We at Picture House released his first film, The Imposter, which was a really superb documentary about this stranger-than-fiction real-life case. And Bart has kind of gone back to a similar area with American Animals, but he's made a very different film. This is based on true events, which are kind of so unreal. It is stranger than fiction again, but he's tackled it in a different way. The film he's made is very different to The Imposter. Both of the films are made with a lot of love, and Bart makes his films look so good on a big screen. He shot both his films in this widescreen 2:3:5 aspect ratio, and I've kind of loved that he's pushing the boundaries with these independent films. Like, these are indie movies, but they look like huge blockbusters, and I think there's a real skill to do that. With American Animals, at Picture House, we were lucky enough to screen this film at the Sundance London Film Festival as our surprise movie. This is a film that originally premiered at Sundance in Utah earlier this year and has been at pretty much every major festival since then, getting rave reviews. And when I saw the film, I saw it completely cold. I didn't really know much about it other than it was directed by Bart Layton. It follows four young lads who are on the road to making the mistake of their lives when they spot that their local library holds the most expensive books in America, and they think that might be quite a soft target to steal and then sell on. They haven't had any sort of experience of this underworld before, so they look to movies to learn how to do a heist, and I'll sort of leave it at that. But the film does feature an incredible cast, including Evan Peters, who some people may know from the X-Men films as the sort of ringleader of this group of boys. He is remarkable. I think this is his best performance I've ever seen, and that character is such a gift. This charismatic kind of ringleader character has to hold the group together. We also have Barry Keoghan in a lead role. He is someone who I was a little bit scared of last year. I saw him in Killing of a Sacred Deer, and that character is quite hard to watch. And in this film, you'll be pleased to hear the character is a little bit more balanced, and we maybe get to see a bit more of a human side to Barry. Remarkable performance from him. And Anne Dowd, who some people who maybe if you've seen The Handmaid's Tale lately, you'll know her as Aunt Lydia. Anne Dowd in this film is probably my MVP. I thought she was superb. Whilst this is a film that you probably don't want to know too much about going in, we keep the chat reasonably spoiler-free. There's no major spoilers in there. However, if you do want to go into the film not knowing very much at all, then maybe download this podcast, maybe listen to this point, as you've done, maybe pause it now, go to the cinema, watch American Animals, and then press play on the way home, and this could be a lovely chat to fill you in on some of the more intricate details on the way back from the cinema. Anyway, I think I've gone on for long enough. Without further ado, myself and Bart Layton, enjoy! Bart, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Oh man, pleasure to be here as always.
It's great to have you on the show. Long-term listeners will remember The Imposter, which was maybe 2012, if my memory is correct.
Yeah, what have I been doing in the last few years?
Hey, it's worth the wait. I know our audiences are really excited to see American Animals. I think for those who've seen Imposter as well, it's a really nice next film on from that.
Yeah, I hope so, yeah. It was weird because, you know, after that, I got offered a lot of surprisingly big sort of Hollywood movies, and which was incredibly flattering. But I don't know, there was something that I couldn't find, you know, even the ones that I got quite close to signing on to, there was something about them which felt like sort of familiar somehow, and that the kind of thing that you might watch on a plane, you right. know. And with this, I think I had that slight itch left to scratch about, is there a middle ground which definitely isn't documentary, and it isn't a straight kind of narrative fictionalization of a true story, but it's this other thing, you know, it's a new way of telling a true story. And I was sort of fixated on experimenting with that and sort of got sidetracked by writing this film and wanting to figure out whether that would work. And it seems that the audiences that have seen it so far or anything to go with seems to have worked.
No, absolutely. I think it's totally unique in terms of its form, and it's quite hard to describe, but I do like that you've got that opening title, which is, you know, this is a true story.
Well, I sort of think what it said at the beginning, it says this is not based on a true story, and then that becomes this is a true story. And the idea being that we're so familiar with going into the movies and you get that kind of caveat, you know, that this is based on a true story, and there's this sneaking suspicion I think we have that, you know, how much is it based? How loosely is it based? And there was so much that didn't need exaggerating or fictionalizing about this story. You know, it was already bizarre and kind of, and also it's a movie about life imitating movies, and you know, and I guess I wanted to make it clear that it hasn't been wildly reimagined. You know, it's very, very close to the truth of what happened. And you know, and there's also that thing where, you know, you get that at the beginning, and then you see a few photos of the real people at the end of the film, and then you go out and you start Googling, you know, what did Molly from Molly's Game really look like? You know, all of that, yes, kind of stuff. And I think with this, I wanted you to kind of have your cake and eat it. You know, you've got these brilliant actors doing what they do, and then also you get glimpses of the real people who perpetrated this desperately ill-advised crime. And I think the effect of that is something we haven't quite seen before, and it's an emotional connection to the story, which gives you as an audience member real skin in the game in a way. You get to really play along.
What I really liked is how you have those different authors almost, and they contradict each other at times. And I really, that adds authenticity to the film. You know, that's not how I remember it. And then you can see it from their point of view.
That's the other thing, is that, you know, when you're doing something based on a true story or trying to tell a true story, and then you interview the key witnesses, I guess, and they remember the exact same incident but completely differently. As a dramatist, you're like, well, which version am I supposed to dramatize, because which one is correct? And with this, I guess I wanted to explore that idea of how not only are these guys fairly unreliable narrators, but you know, memory is not reliable in the way that we like to think it is at all. And so we put that in the movie, you know, just as one person remembers it one way, we then switch to the other perspective and see the same thing happening in a different location according to their memories. And it starts to introduce this idea of how much of this story is something that they've almost reimagined posthumously. And I think probably with these characters, you know, the interesting thing that starts to happen when you make films or documentaries like this is that now they've watched it, you know, the real guys have watched it, the movie version is beginning to eclipse their actual memory.
Right.
Their memories are now being replaced by the version that I've created in the movie, and you know, speaking to them, they're even more confused about it.
As a writer on this, is it quite hard to do that research, but then also to take these four different memories and then turn it into one screenplay?
Yeah, and I'd never written a screenplay before, so I didn't really know, you know, how one starts. And it turns out that the way you start is by literally just starting. And then suddenly you create these characters, and they have conversations, and they have... And if, you know, and if you're clear about who they are and what they want, which is much easier if you've got real people. And, you know, these guys were in prison at the time that I was writing the script. And when I got stuck, I could write to them, or I could occasionally email them and say, just remind me of, you know, what was going through your head at this point, or how do you remember this? And then, of course, as you say, you know, they would remember things differently from one another. And so that initially was a bit of a problem. And then I thought, no, well, maybe that's a clue as to how the structure and the form of the film should work, that we should be almost kind of pulling the curtain back on how stories get fictionalized and misremembered, and, you know, and kind of allowing the audience in on the process a little bit.
What was that process of approaching them and saying, you know, I want to turn this into a film? Was it easier with some people and harder with others? How did you approach that?
I worked with Poppy Dixon, who's the co-producer I work with on The Imposter, who I hope I'll keep working with for as long as she's willing to. And she is kind of hands down the best person to send into a difficult access conversation. There was a lot in the film, and there's a lot about this story that these people were very ashamed about, and it was devastating for their families and for the community they lived in, and so they weren't desperate to revisit it. And we just began this correspondence with them in jail, and we explained kind of who we were and what it was about the story that we felt was interesting, because I think you know, I certainly felt it was a real story of our time, of, you know, of quite lost young men desperate to find an identity, you know, and privileged young men as well, who have been brought up on an expectation that they're going to be important and special, and, you know, and gradually, like most of us, realizing, well, they're not going to be special or interesting. And And so it felt like a lot of what of the crime had come out of that idea of that need to be a somebody. So Poppy and I just began that correspondence. And the one person who I guess was really difficult to get to take part was the librarian, who is the victim of the crime. And, you know, this was a difficult and traumatic experience for her. And I think she was concerned that, you know, she just didn't understand, you know, what it was about the story that I was interested in and how I was going to tell it. And so that was just a question of speaking to her over a number of months and then going to visit her and visit the books that they tried to steal and all the rest of it. And then when I think she understood what it was that the film was going to be about, that it wasn't going to be this kind of glamorization of the crime or any of that, then she kind of agreed to participate. And now she's seen it. She loves it, and actually said to me in an email recently that she's so grateful that the movie happened, because it's allowed her to kind of talk about it and move beyond it and kind of come to some sort of forgiveness towards the real guys. Because now she's sort of began to understand that they weren't really bad. They were just a bit idiotic, you know.
I think that's amazing. What a great thing to come out as a film.
Yeah, no, that was really gratifying, especially is because, you know, she's the person that you really feel, you know, anytime you're telling someone's story, you feel a responsibility for it to be accurate and truthful. And, you know, with the guys, they perpetrated the crime. I wasn't terribly worried about whether they liked the film or not. But with her, given that she was the victim, it felt very important that she felt that it wasn't misrepresentative of her in any way. And also, she's a huge fan of Anne Dowd, who plays her character. So that was helpful.
It's an amazing performance from Anne Dowd. And what I like is that she's introduced at the very beginning. So when the heist happened, there's a lot at stake for her as a victim. It's not like this is the first time you've seen her. Oh, it's a woman who's, you know, it's like, actually, we know her. We know how precious she is of these books and how proud she is. And it's heartbreaking, that scene.
Yeah, it was a tricky one, that, because in a way, you kind of want to be able to almost sort of understand the position that these guys were taking, which was that it was going to be a victimless crime, you know, that the books didn't really belong to anyone, that no one was going to get hurt, that it was a public space, that she was just going to be asked to sort of sit quietly in the corner, and they hadn't really thought about it in terms of, you know, this is another human being and we're going to have to either restrain her or we're going to have to somehow neutralize her, in their words, in some way. And you almost want to be able to sort of sympathize with not the idea of what they're doing, but with their perspective. You want to be able to think, well, you know, it's not going to be a problem. She's not going to put up a fight. But of course, on the day, it's all very different. And so you don't want to make her too much of a character. You want to almost make her an obstacle in the way that they see her. And then, of course, when they get into the room, we and they suddenly realize this is another human being. And in order to do what they're there to do, they're going to need to do something with her. And that's where the crime is. Not the theft, it's the crossing of that line. And that's what the movie is about, in a way.
I think when they're talking about committing the crime, you can sort of relate to them, like, you know, oh, it's a conversation. But when they actually are in the room and they have to approach, what do they do? Do they physically hurt her? Do they have to, however you justify it, that is crossing a line that most people wouldn't do. And I think that's why it's quite, you sit in your seat and you're sort of feeling awkward and quite squirmy, like, oh, guys.
Yeah, and you know what? I don't really think, I think maybe out of the four of them, one of them might have actually thought that they were really going to go through with it.
Mm.
I think they just fell in love with the fantasy of kind of planning a perfect robbery. You know, one of them said to me in one of the letters from prison, that character of Eric, who's played brilliantly by Jared Abrahamson, he said, you know, this was like our version of Fight Club. It was like this secret that we had that no one else knew about. Mm. And it kind of made us different and put us apart from everyone else who was just sort of living this mundane kind of treadmill existence. And so I think that was the thing that they kind of fell in love with, was just this role play. And it just got completely out of hand.
The film, in terms of the pacing, does a really good job of following the what if, the what if, the what if, and then it slowly becoming a reality. And you do work up to the, you know, the sort of the meaty part of the film, which is the heist itself. as a filmmaker, it must be quite fun to plan shooting a heist, considering how, you know, there's a huge cinematic legacy for the heist genre.
There's three versions of the heist in the movie. One, which is sort of how they see it going in their mind. And one of the things that the expressions we used to have on set was, in their minds, it was going to be Ocean's 11. And in reality, it was Dog Day Afternoon, you know. And so the influences and the kind of references range from those super slick kind of heist movies, and then the ones which are so beautifully and meticulously planned, such as, you know, like Rafifi and all of that stuff, to Dog Day Afternoon, which is like one of my favorite films, and which is really almost documentary like in the way the wheels come off. You watch the beginning of that movie and you see the look on Al Pacino's face when he just realizes he's, you know, he can't even get the gun out of the box that he's brought the gun in, you know. And then 5 minutes in, the getaway driver comes in and hands him the car keys and says, I'm really not up for it, I'm afraid you're gonna have to drive. Yeah, there's something so human about that. And so with this, I guess I wanted you as an audience to sort of get lost in the same movie fantasy that they do, and pay homage to some of the tropes of all of those heist movies that we love. But then when the line gets crossed, it is a more, I guess my intention is that when you come away, you know, if you or I, who are not, well, I can't speak for you, sir, but you know, we're not like practiced criminals. If we were going to try and pull off a robbery, you watching this movie will give you a pretty good sense of how that might all unfold if you're not really cut out for it, I think.
No, absolutely. I think playing with people's expectations in the cinema like this is a really great way to, you know, get the audience on side and give them a unique experience. So I just love seeing this on a big screen. I think we need to wrap up there, Bart, but thanks so much for talking to us.
Oh, man.
Can't wait to play this in our cinemas. And like I say, you know, it's shot in this really beautiful widescreen. It's got this amazing soundtrack. It looks incredible. You shoot both your interview sections and the film unlike anything I've ever seen, really. Same with The Imposter, how you bring this really unique look, especially at the Talking Head interviews. They look really cinematic.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. Yeah, funnily enough, we actually almost reversed the process for how that would. So a lot of the non-fiction stuff, you know, the interviews were shot with anamorphic lenses, you know, with CinemaScope, and with I guess the kind of setup you would expect to shoot, you know, fiction, and particularly, you know, using the lenses that we use for those kind of 1970, you know, taking a Pelham 1-2-3 and all of those kind of things. And then we use spherical lenses for most of the for the fiction stuff. So we kind of like inverted some of those processes a little bit.
Nice.
Just to give that, yeah. And also, anytime you put like something that's documentary in a movie, the financiers freak out and like, you sure it's going to look good, aren't you?
Trust me.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Thanks so much, Bart, and best luck with the film.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. Cheers.